everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Thea. For this episode, we will be speaking with Alan Liebert about his first book, Mastering Decline: Stories and Lessons from a Company Making Profit Against the Odds. And we will also be discussing how managers in a declining market should run their companies. Alan Liebert started his career as a management consultant specializing in reorganizing companies on a no-cure, no-pay basis. Following the death of his father, Alan entered the family business, Liebert Textiles, and eventually became CEO, where he turned the business around in a declining market. After 30 challenging years, he left the family business in the capable hands of his children, the fifth generation, only to return to his old love of management consulting. Alan's book, Mastering Decline, provides practical and hard-won advice for managers and owners of any company in a declining market or situation. In doing so, the author highlights key activities that companies in declining markets should focus on in order to secure their future and remain profitable. Thank you, Alan, for joining us today. It's great to have you with us. So, could you tell the story of where your family comes from and how they started the family business?
Well, my family comes from a small town in West Flanders, which is the western part of northwestern part of Belgium, called Wipers or Ypres. My family were all notables. They were doctors, lawyers, notaries, and beer brewers. So that's where they stem from. And the one of the beer brewers' sons married a girl in the small city of Deinze, which is the eastern part of Flanders. And he settled here, and his son started the business when he was 17 years old. He didn't want to go to university, he didn't want to study. And he started the business with a friend of his who was 23 years old, and that's 135 years ago.
Well, yeah, that sounds really interesting. And so you're running a family business. So could you tell us what's the difference between a business that's run by a family and a business that isn't run by a family?
Well, I would say that businesses that are run by families tend to have a longer term perspective, less of a short term knee-jerk, profit-oriented philosophy. But then the downside, so I would say that a family business is better equipped to weather the storm. But on the other side, like I say in my book, the family businesses are often loaded with a lot of emotional issues within the family that are very harmful for the company and for the business. So it's a positive negative game, if you want, family businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's just talk about the textile industry. So in your book Mastering Decline, you mentioned that there is a big decrease in the number of people working in the textile industry. So why is that?
Well, one should not forget that every country in the world has known an industrial evolution and revolution in different phases and at different times. We had our industrial revolution in Europe in the 1900s. The industrial evolution of the countries, the underdeveloped countries, or less developed countries, let's say that way, happened in the 20th century. So it was totally normal that the less evolved industry, and unfortunately textiles is one of them, agriculture is another one of them, was the first stage of development in those countries. So we were confronted after the Second World War with countries like Portugal, then the Maghreb countries, then Turkey, and eventually China and Asia, that started their industrial evolution and started with textiles. And they were producing at much lower costs than we were producing. And that's where all the industry went at the end, especially the garment making industry. The garment making industry was first, and then afterwards came the textiles industry, which requests a little bit more technology, a lot more capital. But at the end, everything went, or 90% of those, both those industries went to the Far East.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand. And then how did the COVID-19 pandemic affect you and your business and the industry as a whole?
Well, in fact, the good thing about us having weathered two world wars, the oil crisis of 73 and a lot of other crises, for us, COVID was just another crisis. So we had to adapt. We had to be flexible. But we had the right mindset and the right people to weather that storm. And I must say that we did quite well during COVID times, because there was a lot of supply problems. We kept our factories open. We supplied our customers. A lot of our customers had a lot of problems being supplied by the Far East. The container costs quadrupled. So everything that was bought locally was a lot easier. So in that sense, we survived quite well. A lot of customers came and bought from us that were not buying from us previously, because we were too expensive. So they came back to us. I don't know if that will last after COVID. We did also a lot of mouth masks. So we changed our production towards the production of mouth masks, which brought us some extra income. So I would say that COVID was just another little glitch in our 135 years history, but not a major one.
All right. So let's just talk a little bit about your book, Mastering Decline. So tell us, why did you decide to write the book and share your story and your tips for management?
Well, I have very good relationship with my children. We talk a lot about business, about the history of our company, about history in general also. And they always ask me why you have a very special management technique. Why don't you write a book about how you weathered all those storms and how you were able to make profit against the odds in a declining market? And I must say that they convinced me. That's the reason why I wrote that book. It's also very therapeutical to write a book, yeah, because you think about a lot of things. It's also an inheritance you leave to your to the next generations. So I found it very soothing during COVID times, because we were not allowed to travel, and I'm a big traveler. So it was a very constructive thing to do during COVID times.
Well, yeah, that's great. All right. So you mentioned how you turned your company around. So could you tell us more about that? When you became CEO of the company, what did you do? How did you turn it around?
Well, when I became CEO of the company, my father just had died. I was 28 years old. And everybody was questioning my capacity in running the business. The suppliers, the customers, my own management team, my own family, or half of the family that was running the company then. So I had to build a team around me that was very resilient, very loyal to me. And I spent a lot of time in building that team. I was also trained as a management consultant, and my philosophy of always looking at the worst case scenario, also being a pilot and always having to study the worst possible outcome, helped me a lot. I mean, one of the basic ways that you have to manage, or that I think you should manage a declining company, is you should always look at what could go wrong. Yeah. Instead of always thinking that everything will go right, well, I first think, what is it going to cost me when it goes wrong? How much am I ready to lose instead of how much am I ready to gain? Which is a completely different philosophy than most of the other CEOs of companies are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So in your book, there was one quote that caught my attention. So as a manager, you should know what you don't know. So why is that important?
Well, if you know what you don't know, at least you can ask for help. And you can ask for help all around you. It can be your wife, can be your children, can be your managers, can be your friends. I think that my experience of a lot of CEOs, that they are geared towards growth, endless growth. And by growing all the time and their successes, they grow an enormous ego. The bigger the ego, the more you will be inclined not to listen to people, and the more you will be inclined to think that you're indestructible. And I think that's one of the big flaws of most of businessmen today, is that they don't take into account the fact that they could be losing business, and that they will have to put their ego aside, yeah, and ask for help. Because I mean, alone, like I write it in my book also, that I have won many battles by people that were maybe more intelligent than me and more capable than me, but they were fighting alone. And I was fighting with a whole team around me. And you will always, always be stronger if you have a team around you that helps you.
Absolutely. That's a great tip. So you just mentioned that a lot of people are focusing on growth. And then in your book, you say that it's vital to focus more on profit than on size. So why is that important? What's the risk if we focus on size?
Well, the risk of the focus on size and low margins does only work if you have endless growth, because the growth brings you the necessary cash. But if you have a setback and you lose 25, 30, 40% of your turnover, and you start with a position where you make very little money, then you will start to lose a lot of money. Yeah, and that's why I would rather have a company that doesn't grow to the stars, but that has enough cash to support a setback. Yeah, I write in my book also that restructuration, especially in Belgium, if you restructure your company, it costs a lot of money to lay off people. It's a very expensive process. So if you don't have the cash and your business is going down, well, you can't even restructure. You just go bankrupt. Yeah. And so that's why I would say that I would certainly concentrate on profits and on margins than on size. Of course, if you're 100% sure that you're going to grow all the time, yeah, then you're a genius. Yeah, and you're very lucky, either or, then you can say, okay, I will work with very low margins and grow forever. But I would say that that's extremely rare, especially now. I mean, with Russia invading Ukraine, with the COVID situation, the energy prices and so on, I think a lot of people that were foreseeing endless growth will now have to live with the fact that they might be confronted with years of decline.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. And then you also mentioned that you had a great team around you all the time. And yeah, having a loyal team is really important for the success of every company. But how can you find that loyal team, those loyal employees for your business?
Well, it's a lot of trial and error, a little bit of luck or a lot of luck. The easiest way is to try to find them within your organization, which is I called the search within your organization. I think there a lot of gold lays. It saves you a lot of time. You know the people, you've been working with them for a long time. But the thing you if you want to build a strong team, the thing you have to give them is your time. It'll take you 5 to 10 years to build a loyal team, a resilient team, a team that works independently and that takes the burden off your shoulders. But before that, you will have to give them a lot of your time. And that's maybe one of the mistakes. Another mistake that a lot of people do is that they don't have the time. They're very bad in time management, and they're busy in running their business and in running sales or whatever, and they don't take time for their team. But there are no miracles. If you want to have a perfect and a good team that works like you would like them to work, but still think independently, you will need to give them a lot of training and a lot of your time.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in the book, you also say that it's really important to be transparent with your employees, and that would be really beneficial for the company. So why is it so important?
Well, one of the big things I learned as a consultant is that one of the first lessons is that if you treat people like assholes, they will act like assholes. Unfortunately, a lot of people are kept out of the main numbers, the main developments into the company, the main philosophy of the company, either because they are blue-collar workers or whatever. I think that if you want people to be committed in the 21st century, you should treat everybody as equal, which doesn't mean that you shouldn't be the captain on the ship. But I mean, if you want people to be committed, they need to know what you expect from them, what they are doing, and they need to receive all the information, all the numbers. And I'm convinced that a lot of people are scared of giving the numbers because they think it will be misused, and that it could backfire on them. But I believe that if you have the right team, it will motivate them to know exactly the numbers in the company.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. And then another interesting point that you make in your book is that you should focus on building a good relationship with your supplier. And that relationship with your supplier is even more important than building that relationship with your customers. So why is that?
Well, I think now, especially now, yeah, you have to see in textiles, but now it's happening in a lot of other industries. A lot of the industry disappeared in Europe, so we don't have a lot of suppliers left. Yeah, and we need to protect them, because if there's no suppliers left, we have to buy everything from Asia with all the problems that come with it, the logistical problems that come with it, the quality problems often that come with it also. So it's a win-win relationship. And as in textiles, very few are left in Europe. The ones that are left in Europe are going to be the companies that are able to supply. So we are now a little bit in a different situation, not only in textiles, but in a lot of other industry, in the electronics industry, with the scarcity of chips and so on. If you have a good relationship and you're a financially strong company, you will get the supply, and other people will not get the supply. Thereby, you will be able to supply your customers, and thereby you will win that part of the battle, which is the economical battle we're all fighting for market share. So I would say that economically speaking, in Europe, a lot of industry have shifted from a customer-oriented industry to a supplier-oriented industry. And that's why I always had a lot of respect, very good relationship with my suppliers, and they really help us in difficult times, not from a financial point of view, but because they really can choose now to whom they deliver. And that's a big strength that suppliers have now. I wouldn't say that we have exactly the same power towards our customers yet, but it is coming there towards there also. We can really help our customers by supplying them because there is a supply shortage.
Absolutely. All right, so another point that you mentioned in Master 21 is that as a manager, you should know every part of the process of the production of your product. So why is that so vital?
Well, in a declining company, you have to know what to tackle first. So you have to know your cost structure and your costs very well, your margins, the margins on your product, how efficient you are in production, how you make your product. I mean, to be able to fine tune the way to survive, you have to be a lot of CEOs of growing company only concentrate on sales or only on development or only on marketing. In a declining company, you cannot afford that. You need to know that you need to know where you're losing money, where you should save money, how you're going to survive. And the only way by doing that is by knowing your production process perfectly.
Absolutely, I agree. All right, so you also, in the book, you also speak about having a flexible structure and that that can really help you if you run a company in a declining market. So can you explain what a flexible structure is and why is it so important to have it?
Well, a flexible structure, I'm talking about a flexible human structure, but it could be a flexible production structure whereby you use machines for different for different goals. Of course, at Liebart in Belgium, our biggest cost is personnel. So we try to have personnel that is able to work in different departments, yeah, and that is multi-skilled. And that allows you to have less personnel, but use them better. So they become much more efficient. Again, you tell them why, because it's the survival of your company. You need them to be flexible. And if you explain to them why, people understand that every minute costs, that it costs 20 times the price of a Chinese minute, unfortunately. Yeah. So they understand that their minute is very valuable and that they should use that minute of that hour as to the better and to the maximization of the efficiency in the company. So that's the horizontal flexibility that we have. But it could be machines that you use for different productions that you can move from one department to another. I mean, that for me is the better way of maximizing the use of your resources. Then you have vertical flexibility. The vertical flexibility is the ability to do the jobs of your subordinates, right? And I have that organized that in my company, especially during COVID times, whereby a lot of people had COVID, were at home and so on. So a lot of the managers had to do blue collar jobs. By doing blue collar jobs, you understand and you respect the people that do the jobs a lot better, and you can improve their jobs. Because a lot of people complain, but as long as you have not done the job yourself, you don't know what they're complaining about. You think it's only a complaint. So that boosted the efficiency enormously. So that's something I would recommend definitely, is that the managers go down and do the works of their subordinates, secretary work, clock work, it could be production work and so on, because that would higher the efficiency and improve the companies tremendously. Vertical efficiency on the other side is a bit more complicated. That would mean that blue collar workers or that secretaries would do the jobs of the bosses. Well, I would say that would be very positive also, because they would maybe understand that being a responsible carries a lot of burden, and that it's not as easy as it seems. It's not about becoming rich and making a lot of money, but it's about white nights, stress, and a lot of issues with your health, with your relationships, and so on. I must say that I have a very good relationship with my personnel, and that most of the people wouldn't want my job. I don't complain. I was born for that job. But most of the people that know what I am doing and what I went through in the last 30 years don't want my job, no matter how much money I made or I could make in the future. They're just not interested.
Yeah, that's really interesting insight. All right, so let's just talk a little bit about marketing. Could you tell us how did you change your marketing strategy since the beginning of the digital era?
Well, I was always very wary, because we were very well known in the industry. So marketing for us, except making fairs and having a nice website and so on, was not really on the forefront of what we needed to do. And I had maybe a little bit of an old-fashioned view on marketing. But my son is one of the specialists in digital marketing, and he always told us that we had to move on, which we basically did. And one of the things we did was build a house of brands. We started to brand our fabrics. We made our own brands of finished products. And there is cross-fertilization between all of our brands. By making finished products, garments, we also learned the power of social media. Yeah, which is something we didn't really needed as an industry. Social media was not needed. As if you make finished products, you need the whole power of the social media and the digital marketing to be able to market your goods. And that was again fertilization for industrial side, which is the fabrics and the narrow side. So we use that also in that part of the business. So I would definitely recommend to use those modern techniques and try to widen your assortment within a company to try to build a more branded approach to your product, definitely.
Great. And then you just mentioned that you started producing finished products. So yeah, could you tell us more about the two sport brands that you created, Recto Verso and RV White? So why did you decide to build your own business to consumer brand after working on a business to business basis for so many years?
Well, it was basically out of frustration. For 25 years, I heard my customers say that we had the most beautiful fabrics and narrows in the world, that we were the most creative company. But unfortunately, very little people were buying from us because we were too expensive. And most of my customers convinced me that we were doing over quality, that our goods were too good for the consumer, so that the consumer wasn't ready to pay for the difference. So out of that frustration, I decided, well, I will create a brand and I will use my own products and I will give to the consumer the best possible product with the best possible fabrics and the best possible narrows. So that's what we created and that's what we did. And I think we are one of the only companies in the world whereby in one company you have narrow weaving, elastic knitting, dyeing, finishing, printing, and garment making in one and the same company, which gives, of course, products that are not only very creative and very beautiful, but that's my opinion, of course, but we have a lot of success with Recto Verso, but that are technically very advanced and have a very, very high quality and are sustainable also, because they are produced 100% in Belgium. Yeah, so that's a unique fate, and which we are very proud of. So that's why I wanted just to prove the market to be wrong, that there is a place for high quality goods and that the consumer does appreciate high quality goods made in Belgium or made in Europe.
Well, yeah, that's great to hear. So you just mentioned sustainability, and then in your industry, sustainability has become a big topic and more customers are looking for sustainable products and brands. So actually, how sustainable is that sector currently, in your opinion? And what is Liber Textile doing to be more sustainable brand? You also mentioned, you already talked a little bit about that, but could you expand more?
Well, there are a lot of aspects to sustainability. I think the first aspect to me, which is the most important thing, is the social sustainability. The sustainability of your personnel, the fact that you treat them well, that they are protected, that they have a social security system, that they have a medical system to support them. And that is definitely something that we've been doing for a very, very long time. So that is the social sustainability, I would say. The other part of sustainability is the ecological sustainability, whereby we are ISO 14001 at Libart. We just had the STEP certification, which is sustainability in textile production. We have we are transiting transitioning to a big part of green energy, solar panels. So we have the most stringent ecological laws in the world in Belgium. So from that point of view, sustainability is something that is in our DNA. I would say, from a recyclability point of view. We are about to recycle our water also, our dying water, but as it's not as easy as people think, because reusing the water we need to use needs to be extremely clean to die. So although we have a water cleaning facilities whereby we clean our water completely, it is still not clean enough to be reused in the dyeing bath. But we are investing further in further cleaning technology, and we will be soon able to reuse that that water also. From a garment recyclability or a waste recyclability, it is still a difficult process because we have a blend of fibers, of nylon, of lycra, and so on. And for the moment, they are not able to recycle those blended mix of fibers. But from on the other hand, with the garment production, people are able to return the garments. We will repair them so they can reuse them. And I think that's also a big way of guaranteeing sustainability, is making sure that the garments lasts longer by giving a better quality. So we are for slow fashion and not fast fashion. I think if you buy an expensive garment from Recto Verso, it will last longer. It is not a ready to throw garment like most of the other garments. So automatically you will buy less and it will last longer.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see all of the different things that you are doing for sustainability, which is of course great. All right, so finally, my last question to you would be, what would be your top three tips for every CEO or manager currently trying to run a company in a declining market?
Well, I would say surround yourself with a loyal and resistant team. Second, always take into account the worst case scenario and then protect your margins. That would be my three main objectives that I would have as a CEO.
That's great. Thanks very much for this insightful conversation. I think that's going to help a lot of CEO or managers. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Thea.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lead Publishing on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and at Lead Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lead Radio Podcast.